This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Momentum Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, which is an organization and community devoted to exploring these very themes. During this episode of Momentum Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today we're going to meet a woman who has been devoted for years to excavating and rethinking the figure of the witch, and looking at the relationship between creative practice, which includes art making, music and film, and pretty much anything else you can imagine, and magic itself.
Darkness and shadow is a healthy part of experience. And I think it's also important to make the distinction that darkness is not evil. And certainly people confuse this and think that witches are evil. And by and large, that is not true, at least in modern practice. There's always assholes in every group, right? But generally speaking, like the witches I know are so loving, and a lot of them are activists and socially conscious and certainly environmentally conscious. But yeah, darkness is not evil. Darkness is healthy and holy.
Before we begin, if any of you have felt a connection to something mysterious or even possibly magical as you engage in your creative work, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Hi, my name is Maya. My grandfather died when he was 54 years old. It was sudden. It upended my mother's life and left my grandmother in a permanent state of shock. He died laughing over a drink, two things he enjoyed the most. My grandfather's brown skin turned blue as he choked on his food. Unfortunately, it was not the shade of blue that would be recognizable as concerning to a room full of white people. He was in Amsterdam on a business trip. When it was clear that something was wrong, an ambulance was called and he was treated for a heart attack while his brain slipped away. My family rushed to Amsterdam, grandfather on life support. I wonder what it was like for my mother to have to decide to let her father go when he was already gone. The only memory I have of my grandfather was in a dream. My grandfather in a cream suit and a pink tie came to say goodbye as he was traveling on a business trip. I cried and begged him not to go. He said not to worry. Everything would be okay. You're not going to come back, I said to him. He smiled knowingly, gave me a hug, and left.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. So today I want to welcome Pam Grossman. And Pam Grossman is a writer, curator, and educator who is best known as the creator and host of The Witch Wave, a long-running podcast featuring artists, academics, occult practitioners, and cultural thinkers exploring spirituality, creativity, and the esoteric. She is also with Professor Jesse Bransford, co-founder of the Occult Humanities Conference, a multidisciplinary event held at NYU that explores the intersections of art, scholarship, and esoteric traditions. Pam is the author of Waking the Witch, Reflections on Women, Magic, and Power, and co-author with Jessica Hundley of the Toshin Library of Esoterica's beautiful book, Witchcraft. Her newest book, Magic Maker, The Enchanted Path to Creativity, explores through both theory and practice the relationship between art and magic. So I've known Pam since before Morbid Anatomy was even a sparkle in my eye, I think. When I met her, and I don't remember how we met, maybe you might remember, was it at an Obscura event or did I?
Yes, Lord Whimsy's book party.
But when I first met Pam, I was in awe of this beautiful blog that she was producing called Phantasmophile, which became part of the inspiration for my own Morbid Anatomy project. I don't think I would have thought of creating a blog if I hadn't seen what Pam had done in a way that kept it beautiful, interesting, accessible, but always rigorous and curiosity-driven. And Pam also became a member of Observatory, an arts collective that we founded in 2008, which ended up serving as an incubator not only for Pam's work, which I'd like to hear more about, and for Morbid Anatomy, but also for Atlas Obscura and a variety of other idiosyncratic projects. It has been really wonderful over these years watching Pam's work evolve and grow. And it's wonderful to have her on the show. Welcome, Pam.
Oh, Joanna, I'm so happy to be here. And I'm just like beaming and also feeling very nostalgic. So thank you for that.
I'm feeling nostalgic too. And writing that introduction, I really realized how intricately our paths have been combined. And so we met at a Lord Whimsy book party. Where was it? Was that at Obscura?
It was indeed. Yes. Yes. And I was so nervous to go. I still remember what I was wearing.
I remember what you were wearing. It was a Luna moth dress, right?
Yes. A dress covered in moths. Yes. And I think that was our kind of icebreaker.
I think it was.
But I had wanted to go to this book party and I was nervous and, you know, much more socially shy than I am now. And my husband, who, you know, Matt, is an extrovert. And he was just like, I'll come with you. Let's go. At the time, he was just my boyfriend. And so we went and then we struck up a conversation, you and I, and I think it was about Jung.
I believe it was.
And then we were off to the races.
Yeah. And here we are so many years later. And it's really mm-hmm. fantastic. So, you know, I realize because we've been friends for so long, there are so many questions I've never asked you. So I don't really know your trajectory and how you got here. So I want to ask you some questions. Well, first of all, how did you first become interested in magic, witchcraft, and occult history?
Always, always, always. I mean, the line that I say probably far too often is like, I was one of those kids who was hanging out at the low end of the Dewey Decimal System. So like where all the weird shit about dragons and witches and UFOs and Bigfoot, like that was my jam. And I was a really imaginative kid. I was really precocious. I was a very early reader. Mm. And I just loved getting lost in the space of mythology and enigma, you know? So I just kind of kept going with it. And I'm very fortunate that I had two parents who are both very artistic and they encouraged it. You know, they took me to occult bookshops if I wanted to go or new age stores. Like they didn't try to squelch that interest. And so it just flourished.
What drew you to that particular expression of spiritual practice and how did identifying as a witch, like publicly identifying as a witch, what was that decision like?
I mean, it's been such a gradual process as I think it is for a lot of people who practice witchcraft. The quickest answer is when I was a preteen, I became curious about literal witches and spells. When I was probably about 12, I bought my first tarot deck. I bought a oracle deck that was called Russian, and this is not a politically correct word anymore, but it was called Russian gypsy fortune telling cards or something like that. And between those two things, I got very swept up in this idea of divination. And then I got into like the harder stuff. So buying spell books and experimenting with casting spells. Wow. Some of which were benevolent and some of which I'm embarrassed to say were not so kind. And one of those not so kind spells actually worked and it freaked me out.
Can you speak more to, yeah, please tell the story.
That's yeah, I know. I know your ears are pricking up, Joanna. I tell this story in Waking the Witch, which is there was this girl in middle school. She wasn't a very nice person in my perception. She was also dating someone I had a crush on. So double trouble right there. I cast a spell that was harmful. It wasn't trying to kill her or anything, but it was trying to, you know, make her not have a great day. Let's put it that way. And I didn't have all the weird ingredients. I think there was something like a black egg I was supposed to have, or dragon's blood or something that I did not have access to in suburban New Jersey. So I just kind of like freestyled and used, you know, the spices in my mom's cabinet. And I think you had to like stab a piece of leather with a needle, or I don't even remember all of it. The next day she came in and she was covered with boils. They were sun blisters. She had fallen asleep because she was tanning and just had all these sun blisters all over her body. And I was not happy. I was totally freaked out. And I felt really responsible and scared. And I felt bad for her.
Yeah.
You know, listen, whether or not I actually caused that or it was coincidence, it remains in this liminal space. But the upshot of it is, I was like, I am never doing malevolent magic again. And I never have since that point. But, you know, I evolved. I kept casting spells, doing rituals. I got very connected to the goddess Artemis, the Greek goddess of the moon and the wild and independence, who is still my primary deity. It really just evolved and evolved throughout high school. Then I got to college. I went to NYU and I sort of hid it away. I went more into the space of trying to intellectualize magic. So I took a lot of classes in anthropology, which was my major. And also I minored in art history, religious studies, and creative writing. But it was really just so I could study consciousness, magic, symbolism, ritual. And then once I got out of college, I realized I was really longing for that identity and that practice again. I cast a spell because I was looking for a teacher. Hmm. And the very next day I was led to my teacher, Robin Rose Bennett, who is an amazing green witch. And I started taking classes with her, studying with her, joining her coven, her apprenticeship. And it was through working with her and the group that we gathered with that I began to feel braver about calling myself a witch in public.
One thing I love about the tradition of witchcraft as opposed to many other contemporary spiritual traditions is that it does not deny or attempt to suppress, I guess I'd say, or includes. It has an inclusion towards the dark side, and including death, which of course is something dear to the Morbid Nami community. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners a bit more about how those things function in this practice.
Hugely. So witchcraft, I should say modern witchcraft, as we conceive of it now, really is about certainly casting spells and trying to transform one's life or transform the world, whether that's literally or figuratively, and we can maybe tease that out later. But it's also about honoring the full spectrum of nature and the full spectrum of our own inner natures. And what that means is, if you're following the modern pagan wheel of the year, for example, and celebrating the Sabbats or the pagan holy days, you are celebrating essentially an agrarian cycle of birth, growth, cultivation, and then, yes, harvesting and death. And that means you're celebrating the seasons, you're celebrating the cycles of the moon, and doing certain rituals and energetic activities that kind of map onto those different shifts. And it means that within yourself, you're honoring your own shadow, your own winter. Mm. You're honoring your ancestors who have crossed over and maintaining a relationship with them. So darkness and shadow is a healthy part of experience. And it's something that we believe is healthy to integrate and celebrate within our own practice. And I think it's also important to make the distinction that darkness is not evil.
Right.
And certainly people confuse this and think that witches are evil. And by and large, that is not true, at least in modern practice. There's always assholes in every group, right? But generally speaking, like the witches I know are so loving, and a lot of them are activists and socially conscious and certainly environmentally conscious.
Absolutely.
But yeah, darkness is not evil. Darkness is healthy and holy.
Yeah, I love that. And obviously, all of that resonates for me. And it also makes me think about some of the difference and relationship between so-called white and black magic and what those things are. And I think that black magic is what's given witches a bad name, right? And the stigma that maybe is still there. But I wonder if you could speak a bit to that.
Sure. And it's interesting because, and I know this is being a little bit, I don't know, nitpicky, but even that language has a little bit fallen out of fashion just because of certain like racist implications.
Of course.
What do we say now? Some people say left-handed or right-handed magic. Some people say malefic and benefic magic.
I like that much better.
But essentially, like, we're talking about harmful magic and healing or helpful magic, right? But it's funny, I used to have this very black and white version of that where it's like, well, I don't do hexes, I don't do curses, I don't want to harm people, but I will do magic that protects the people I care about, that protects myself, my home, my community. You know, for example, we have a differentiation between a curse and a binding spell, where a curse is about trying to harm somebody and a binding spell is about trying to, if you picture like binding someone's hands behind them energetically, where you're preventing them from doing harm.
Yeah.
I mean, is binding someone harming them and all those things? I recently talked to a woman who would be very interesting, I think, for you to talk to at some point if you don't know each other already. She calls herself the Death Witch.
I don't her know name her.
She's wonderful. She comes from a Latinx tradition, and she's now a conjurer and root worker. Her name is Loretta Ledesma. And she really helped me understand that she reframes this conversation around the idea of justice magic. And justice magic is something to deploy with a lot of care. But in her understanding of it, it's like sometimes you do have to kind of mess up someone's day if they're going to, I don't know, take your family away. You know, like if ICE is coming, you might want to mess up that person's day, not hurt them necessarily or harm them, but you know, we're talking about life and death here. We're talking about justice. And so I understand that I have a lot of privilege as a white person in America, where the levers of justice through the traditional routes of, you know, the police and courts and things are going to be kinder usually to people who look like you and me than they are to people who are not white. And so anyhow, my thinking around this kind of magic has been evolving. I still don't believe personally in hexing people and cursing people, but I understand why people with a lot of care and thought and responsibility might sometimes use those tools if they feel absolutely desperate. So I'm thinking about those things a lot. I don't have the answers, but I understand that it's not a simple issue.
No, that totally resonates for me. And from my experiences of touring different facilities devoted to Santa Muerte, you know, one of the colors of Santa Muerte, Saint or Holy Death, for listeners who are not familiar with her, from the Mexican tradition, takes the form of a female Grim Reaper, is black. We might say harmful magic, but it was protection. And I had exactly the same realization that these are people that can't necessarily just call the police when something goes wrong. So this is their way of finding justice and protecting themselves.
Exactly. And you know, I think this also comes down to some of those debates that we're having outside the witchcraft community. It's like, is it okay to punch a Nazi? You know, some people would say absolutely, and other people would say, I don't want to turn into a violent person, no matter what violence is coming my way. And it's going to be different for everybody. But I will say that by and large, most of the witches that I know, and I know a lot of them, are doing magic that is creative and loving and compassionate. And it's not just about being a jerk and trying to hurt people.
Totally. And I don't want to jump ahead. I definitely want to talk about your new book, where I love that you've really, really honed in on this relationship between magic and creation. And that's something that I've always, or have for a long time been musing on as well, the kind of strange, mysterious aspects of real creative work. But before we get there, I would love to know what inspired you to create your podcast.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I started the Witch Wave at a time in my life when I was still working at my day job. I worked at Getty Images,
as you remember.
This creative but very corporate creative company. I worked there for 14 years, but I was doing things like our project observatory, my blog Phantasmophile, curating art shows on the side. That was my true passion. And podcasts were just starting to bubble up when I began the Witch Wave. I began it, gosh, I always get confused if it was in 2017 or 2018. I'm in my ninth season this year, so we can do the math.
Congratulations.
But thank you. You know, I'm a big podcast person. I was starting to listen to podcasts back then. I also love NPR, and I would listen to shows like Krista Tippett's, it's now called On Being, which is probably the most popular, or at least it was at the time, show about modern spirituality. Mm. And to be honest, Joanna, with all respect to Krista Tippett, I was really frustrated with the fact that she would talk to people who were Buddhist and people who were mystic Christians and rabbis and scientists. She did not, and I believe still has not, had a witch on the show. She's flirted with paganism sort of loosely in like a Celtic way. But generally speaking, she's stayed away from that. And it just kind of bugged me because I'm like, there are millions of people who are pagan and certainly, you know, millions of witches in the world. And so even if it makes you uncomfortable or you don't understand it or you don't believe in it, whatever the hell that means, we exist. And why wouldn't you want to talk to us? And not even me, like at the time, I'm trying to remember if Margot Adler was still alive, but Starhawk certainly is still alive. Why wouldn't she want to talk to Starhawk or Phyllis Curat or some of the other elders who are so brilliant and who have beautiful things to say about magic, creativity, nature? So I kind of had a bee in my bonnet about it. And so that was part of it, was wanting to start my own version of it. But I also, you know me, I curse a lot. I'm really into music and movies and fashion and, you know, TV. Like I also wanted to bring a contemporary cultural angle into it. And I loved interviewing people on Phantasmophile. I just got such a kick out of meeting these people who inspire me. And I love to ask questions. So yeah, lots of reasons, but those are some of the ingredients that went into it.
Yeah. And, you know, we kind of jumped right over this, but what inspired you to do Phantasmophile in the first place?
Oh my goodness.
That was so long ago. And what year did you start it?
2005.
Wow. That is super early for blogs.
What's crazy about it is the platform that I used, TypePad, just closed down 2 months ago. And so I had to export, and that's my 20-year anniversary. Not that I was even typing into it very often over the last several years, because Instagram kind of filled that space for me and the podcast. Even so, once in a while I would check in, and I still liked having it up as an archive. Yeah. I had to export 20 years of this blog into the tiniest TXT file, which of course, like all the images are gone, whatever.
Oh, so
it's just
sad.
Gone. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, yeah.
But anyhow, I started Phantasmophile. Gosh, I don't know. I'm just one of these people, and I know you are too, Joanna. When I love something, I want to share it with people, and I want to shine a spotlight on something that enlivens me and inspires me. And that's just kind of my nature. But in addition to that, you know, I've always been someone who has loved magic and art and the place where those things overlap. And Phantasmophile was my space to do just that. It was mostly about visual art, but it was a lot about music and film and so on too. So much of what I do, and I think, again, I presume you're similarly, you're wired similarly, is I make the things that I can't find and I wish existed. And I'm like, fuck, I guess I'll have to make it.
Same. Yeah, absolutely same. And, you know, I want to kind of come back to what you're saying about the relationship between magic and art, because I haven't finished it. I have to confess, but I've been listening to your new book. And I think it's so amazing how you have taken this incredibly rich, complex history of each of the things you talk about and worked it in a very seemingly effortless way. But I know from being a writer, it's really hard to do what you're doing, to put all of that information and have it flow and have it be conversational. But such an incredible encyclopedia of the history of magic and the history of creativity. And then also having it be a book that is inspirational and helping people incorporate these practices into their own life. And I think it's really amazing to see you bringing all of those things together. It almost feels like your kind of final, I don't want to say your final word because who knows, but like how I felt with my Memento Mori book, kind of like, okay, everything I want to say is in this book. And I don't even know if I need to write about death anymore.
Let me just say that when I interviewed you about your book on The Witch Wave, I felt the exact same way. Like, I just felt like, wow, here's Joanna, who I've known for so long, who I've watched evolve. And I've loved so many of your other books and projects, but it felt like Memento Mori was like your magnum opus.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for.
It's so touching to me that you're having, you know, I don't want to presume, but maybe like a similar reaction.
Exactly the same.
And it's touching to me too, that you and I continue to have this kind of aligned path. I find it really moving.
I know, I do too.
Magic Maker, again, it's like a book I wish existed. And it sounds so like dramatic to be like, it's a lifetime in the making. But it really feels like that with this book. Like my love of magic and creativity goes back even earlier probably than my love of witches specifically. I love witches. And I am a witch and I'm a proud witch, but that's one facet of like many other things that I am and that I'm interested in. And so Magic Maker really was my space to try to synthesize all of these different passions of mine that revolve around this notion that magic and creativity are related, or perhaps in fact, one and the same thing. And it really is this moment, I think, for me, of personal integration, where for such a long time, my witch self and my creative self as like a writer, a blogger, a curator, a performer, whatever, they felt sort of like parallel or bifurcated. And then I realized within the last decade, I'm like, oh, they're the same fucking thing. Like I'm doing the same thing in terms of trying to enter this liminal zone wherein I can collaborate with something else, whatever we want to call that something, and through rituals and techniques, I'm able to deepen that connection and invite in this inspiration. And that doesn't mean I'm a passive vessel. That can be one technique wherein some of the creativity can come through channeling and things like that. But as a human being, you're also a really important half of that equation. Yeah. You get to put in your intentions and your tastes and your labor and, you know, your editing and your shaping of this force. But I do believe that forging that connection between you and whatever that other thing is with intention and with certain techniques, if you so choose to use them, it can really help. It can really help you get out of your own way. It can really help the process become, I wouldn't say easy, but more fruitful, more easeful, less anxious.
Yeah.
At least that's what's happened for me. And so I wanted to share that with other people in hopes that it would help them. And I'll just say one more thing, which is, it's not just like the Pam Grossman methodology. I wasn't interested in doing something like that. I wanted to show that people have been doing this for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And especially some of our most celebrated artists like David Bowie, David Lynch, Sylvia Plath, Lucille Clifton, Beyonce, they've been using these magical techniques, whether or not they call it magic themselves. And so it's a real celebration of a lot of artists who inspire me too.
Yeah. And it's wonderful that you bring in the popular culture aspect, because I think that helps people who might be resistant to the links you're making see. I mean, when the quote, you had a great quote from Beyonce where literally she was saying she created an alter ego, right, to produce a certain body of work because she didn't feel she could do it. And then at a certain point, that alter ego ended up ending because she no longer needed it. I mean, there's, you use incredible examples. And I definitely urge any listener who's interested in creative practice and the mysteries of creative practice, and also the history of magic, I have to say. Like, you've done such a thorough job of doing like a very, very complex history of magic as well. And I think it's really, really impressive to me how you've put all this together and made it accessible. And I wonder, for listeners who might be interested in thinking about connecting to something beyond themselves, and again, as you said, I love your agnosticism, right? Whether that's the unconscious or whether that's the land of the dead or whether that's spirit, however you want to conceive of it, do you have any advice, like an easy-to-do ritual or easy-to-do practice that someone could try at home?
Yes. First, can I just say thank you, Joanna, for like being so kind and generous with your words about the book.
I think it's really amazing, you know, to take something so, well, to many people, let's be honest, frightening, right? Or intimidating, to speak in a way that rationalists can understand and make really good arguments, I thought, about taking it seriously. It's never a finger wagging kind of thing. It's more a opening people to thinking critically about the criticism that has been lodged and using, you know, common sense to do so. And I think, again, this is to do something with an area that already has so much baggage and so much malignment or so much fear. It's really just incredible. It's very matter of fact. It's very accessible. And it's lovely. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you, my friend.
And I will say, well, the other thing I really love just to our conversation about the difficulties of making is you bring in your constant doubt while writing the project. And I think that's even that, to see that written down is such, I think, an important or at least a really useful thing to remember, that part of the process is just learning to know ourselves and know our minds and what our minds, what minefields our minds might throw up at various points to bring fear. And if you have awareness of that, you can say, okay, I'm feeling this way this moment, but I know it's not really what I think, and you can step back. So giving people that tool as well, I really appreciate.
Yes, thank you. And I think you're referring to a section I wrote on demons and these creative demons Indeed. That show up to thwart us. But let me yeah. answer your question before I derailed us. So a couple rituals that come to mind that I think are pretty easy. I'll give sort of like a very beginner answer and then maybe one that's a little more complicated. So I think something that people can try, even if it feels a little goofy, is to do what I call strike magician's pose before they start to write. And, there's a whole conceit in the book about the magician card of tarot being this great anchor archetype for any creative person. And I'm not the biggest tarot head. Like I am friends with some of the most amazing tarot people in the world, as you are too. But I do love tarot, and I certainly love the major arcana and know that part of the tarot pretty intimately. And the magician has one arm up and one arm down because they are the bridge between worlds. They are a human being, crucially, that is connecting the realms of the divine and the mundane, the celestial and the terrestrial. We could go on, masculine, feminine, as above, so below, all the different binary pairs. And as this connector between them, they are kind of this this being who can close this electric current and turn force into form. They're the great manifester of the tarot. And so I think they're a perfect image for an artist or anybody, any creative person. You can be a politician, a parent. It doesn't matter. We're all creative or have the ability to be. And so I have this exercise in the book where I literally have people put one arm up and one arm down and envision inspiration and divine energy flowing through their body and then shooting it out their downward arm. And then also you can then, I believe it's a closed circuit. So then whatever you make, you then offer it back up to the divine, or the capital O other, or capital S spirit, God, whatever word you want to use. And it just helps me, that little meditation. And sometimes I'll even say out loud, I am the magician. I am the magician. I am the magician. And it just kind of activates something in me. So people can try something like that. That's kind of a quick little thing they can do. And then something that's perhaps a little more 102, a little more advanced, is I'm a big fan of altar making, as I know you are too. And not only do I have altars to my different deities and spirits all around where I live, but I've started doing altars for my projects. So I have a book altar for Magic Maker. It mostly has figurines of Mercury on it, because Mercury is kind of the guiding god of this book, or Hermes, as he's known in Greek. But it also has, you know, some other, it has an ancestor candle, so I can ask for guidance from my ancestors. It has, I'm just looking at it.
Yeah, I can
now
see that you're looking at it. I kind of want to.
It also crucially has, when I finished the first draft of Magic Maker, I put it on the altar. Mm. Now I have my published copy of Magic Maker. It's on the altar. And so I use this altar to try to ask, you know, spirit for help, yeah, in certainly inspiration while writing the book, but also to ask for help that this book will do the most good that it possibly can in the world and find the people it's meant to find.
Yeah. And you know what I love about that too, is I feel like doing those sorts of rituals really helps reduce the anxiety around whether, like, I feel like most of us in this capitalistic world, there's a part of our mind that's constantly like, is it good enough, or is it, yes, going to be successful or whatever? But when you try to connect with something beyond yourself, whether, again, you think of that as the unconscious or a spirit being, I think, is irrelevant. When you take it out of your intellect and put it into something else, then I feel like it, at least for me, really frees me up to engage in expression in a more free way that sometimes can produce really surprising results. And I think that's something that the modern people have, this burden that our ancestors did not, that it's all on us, that it's all our intellect, that if something's wrong, we have to fix it. And there's something so liberating and taking the weight off of us to try to connect to something beyond our intellect.
That's it right there.
Yeah.
And that is what has helped me so much as a creative person, because I'm someone, first of all, I'm just someone who battles anxiety in my life, like clinically. It's hooray, Ashkenazi Jewish genes. What can I say?
I have it too, like, fam. I have it too.
Oh, I know. You're in the tribe.
Epigenetics. Who knows?
That's it. So I think so many people are living with anxiety right now. Yeah. This is a very anxious time to be alive. A lot of these things help me get past my anxiety, for sure. And I'm also somebody who can be very stuck in her head,
yeah,
who can be very analytical, very critical, mostly self-critical. And to your point, these techniques help quiet those voices and helps shift my creative process, not totally away from my mind and my ego, but less so.
Yeah.
It becomes also about trusting intuition, trusting spontaneity and surprise and inspiration,
totally,
and playfulness. And also to trust that if things come out of me in my writing, let's say, that are weird or unexpected, just to go with it. You can always edit it later or take it out, but usually those weird rabbit holes have the most fruitful pockets of delight and discovery in them.
Yeah.
So all of these techniques have really helped me get there more easily.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Pam. I want to end with three questions that I've been asking all of our interviewees. The first one is, looking back over your career, do you think that the idea of death in any way animates your life and work?
100%.
Tell me about that.
I think about my death constantly, maybe too much, honestly, Joanna, but I feel this urgency to make the most out of my life. I feel so lucky to be a person. And in my thinking, and again, I don't have these answers, but in my thinking, if we are souls who get to have bodies for a little while, I want to maximize that experience. I want to make everything that I can possibly make. I want to learn everything I can learn. I want to taste every flavor of ice cream. You know what I mean?
I do.
And so having this deep awareness of my own mortality makes me, sometimes it puts too much pressure on me, honestly, but the upside of it is that it gives me this motivation to not waste time and to just have as much fun and use my gifts as much as I'm able to, and try to hopefully make the world better while I'm here, if possible. But also just like have a real good time while I get to drive around in this little body for a while.
I love that, Pam. I wasn't expecting that answer, so it's even better. Another question. If you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
Fuck no. Wait, actually, Joanna, what's my body doing in this living forever? Is it decaying?
No, I don't think so. I think this is just like kind of like vampiric, like, you know, you're frozen.
So I'm healthy and vital.
Yeah, you're healthy and you're vital, but time.
Ooh, that changes. Okay, changes the stakes. No pun intended. Let's see. I still don't think I would. I think that death gives our life shape, and it really heightens meaning. And I think also if everybody else around me is mortal, I think it would be too heartbreaking to lose everyone and everything I love at some point. So no, I don't think I would.
Okay. And finally, has your work changed your thoughts about death and what happens after?
Yes. Yes. Mostly in terms of my relationship to my ancestors. I was not one of those like ancestral magic witches for most of my life. It's actually relatively recent. I'm 44. And it was during the pandemic that I got way more interested in my own Jewish mystical roots, my own connection to Jewish folklore, Jewish folk magic. Mm. And I started getting into genealogy and really cultivating a practice of ancestral magic. And I tell you what, my life has become so much more vibrant, and I've felt so much more guided and supported since forging those connections more intentionally. I have a friend named Susan Aberth. You might know her, Joanna.
Yeah, I know her.
Yes, ingenious Leonora Carrington scholar and art history professor.
She's fantastic.
She's also very magical. And at one point in my life, she's a dear friend of mine. At one point in my life, she said to me, Pam, if you don't ask them, they can't help. And so I was like, huh, I haven't really asked my ancestors for help and guidance. And I've tried it. And they seem to really like it, and they seem to really be helping. So it's not just what they can give me. It's also, I feel like they are happier and more settled with the fact that I am remembering them. I'm doing things in their honor. I'm keeping their stories and names alive in my work and in my life. And so, yes, that has changed immensely, and really within the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years.
Oh, that's incredible, Pam. I would love to talk to you more about that when I see you next. And yes, with that, I'm going to end by asking, where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
Thank you. The easiest is my website, pamgrossman.com. I have an Instagram where I'm most active at Phantasmophile, that's spelled with PHs. I have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/witchwave, where I do monthly rituals online, and there's ad-free Witchwave episodes, but also bonus Witchwave episodes. Of course, there's the Witchwave podcast, and I started YouTubing. I don't know. I'm not very good at it, but you can check those out at Phantasmophile on YouTube as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Pam. And do check out her book, which has just come out this year, just this month,
last month. Yeah. It's been out for a month.
Well,
yeah.
Congratulations. And Pam, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation.
Thank you so much, Joanna. I'm so honored and I continue to be such a fan of yours. So this was a real thrill.
It's completely mutual. Thank you, Pam. So after each episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to meet up and just have a little chat while everything is still fresh in our brains about what we felt about the conversation. And as always, I'll turn it over to Jess first because I've known Pam for a very long time. I have a big understanding of her body of work, but this is probably pretty new for you. And what were your thoughts, Jess?
Well, after that conversation, I jumped up like a little puppy and ran into the studio because I was so excited. I loved it. I got a lot from that conversation. So in preparation for today, I've been listening to The Witch Wave, and I think I will carry on listening to that podcast. I've really been enjoying it. There were so many things that I picked up on, you know. It's that importance. In the beginning, you guys were talking about darkness and evil being different things, and the importance of darkness in the human experience, you know, which is something that people can want to avoid or think is bad.
Yeah, or fear.
Yeah, absolutely. When you asked the question that you asked about how death has animated her work or life, and the way that Pam described, you know, like if we're a soul, and we get to be in this body for a little bit of time. So eat all the different flavors of ice cream, you know, use your time, do things, you know, that's so inspirational, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And characteristically accessible at the same time. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's one of the things that Morbid Anatomy is really all about, is trying to remind ourselves that when we think about death, it's not morbid and it's not self-defeating. It's not dreary. Rather, it encourages us to live, because the brevity of life is also what gives it its meaning, right?
Absolutely. For me, your book, Memento Mori, does that as well. There's lots of little exercises in it. And by acknowledging that there will be an end to our physical existence, it just gives extra vibrancy, I feel. Yeah. And yeah, Pam explained that beautifully, I think. She said that death gives our life shape and heightens meaning. And I couldn't agree more. My last thing I want to say was I found my ears pricked up when she started talking about the Jewish mythical roots and things like that. That's not something I know anything about, but I would be really interested in learning more about.
Likewise.
Yeah. Well, maybe there. Another episode.
Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah, look at that. Okay. Yeah,
great. Thank you, Jess.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com. Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.